I want to get back to our ongoing consideration of what I've been calling the relocation of hope. Last week, we sort of deconstructed this idea that everything happens for a reason. And I made the suggestion that the event at the center of the Christian narrative, the crucifixion, can be understood as an event that makes no sense, that essentially undoes any attempt to build a complete system of belief that uses that event as the centerpiece, because that event shatters all of our expectations about interactions between the divine and humanity. And we talked a little bit about the Apostle Paul's take on all of this in 1 Corinthians, where he says that the crucifixion works as neither wisdom nor as a sign, but confounds both. And rather than belief or sight being the desired spiritual path, Paul uses the word faith to describe the best possible way of relating to God. And so, as part of that reflection, I left us with this question to ponder. What if there was a different way of understanding faith that operated outside of the realms of what we typically think of as meaning-making? Or to put it another way, what if there was a way of having faith that, despite that way not being affiliated with certainty, still carried with it a type of confidence such that it could move us to action in the world rather than primarily producing a kind of pining for another world? And that's the question that I want to pick up on this morning. I'll restate it when we get a little closer to that consideration. But before I do, I want to set this conversation into a wider, older context. Today is, among other things, the first Sunday of Advent. Advent, for those not familiar with it as a liturgical season, is a significant season of the liturgical calendar of Christian tradition, and traditionally marks a time of waiting, a time of seeking. It's actually remarkably like Lent. And the season of Advent lasts until Christmas, Christmas Day, when the Christian tradition marks the birth of Jesus. Now, why does it matter to practice waiting, and what does that have to do with relocating things like hope or faith? We're going to explore that in more depth next Sunday. I'm going to just sort of take a break from all of these philosophical deliberations, and we're going to talk about Advent for the talky bit. But for now, let me just suggest one reason why I think this matters. When we choose to engage in deliberate, conscious waiting, one of the results is often that we find ourselves thinking. We find ourselves wrestling with important questions with ourselves, with our values, with the way that we engage in everyday life, and what sort of impact that might have on us, what sort of impact our choices about everyday life might have on our neighbors, both local and global, what sort of impact our choices about how we live might have on the planet we call home, and so on. One of the things that waiting does is it slows down our sometimes hyperactive brains and psyches, and it gives our spirits time to catch their breath. Time for being human beings and not just human doings. And so it is an opportunity, among other things, to hit a large and often really needed reset button for our own lives. And one of the other things that can start to emerge when we practice waiting is the ability to be more present to what is now. And that has an important connection, I think, to the question that I posed at the beginning about the possibility of a kind of faith that moves us into action here and now, rather than primarily provoking longing for some other time and some other place. So let me just restate that question again, because of our little pro-Advent detour here. What if there was a way of having faith that, despite it not being affiliated with certainty, still carried with it a type of confidence such that it could move us to action in the world rather than primarily producing a kind of pining for another world? Let's think about the nature of that type of confidence that I referred to there for a bit, because lots of us have been raised in religious systems where certainty and confidence, if they're not actually synonyms, they're symbiotic. They depend on one another for their existence. And the kind of confidence that doesn't depend on certainty, that even embraces uncertainty, might feel like a rather foreign idea. I'm going to suggest that the kind of confidence that embraces uncertainty might be most easily seen in what we tend to call love. And I've talked about this idea before and its connection to making systems of meaning. If we believe that the world is meaningful, but we don't love, we're most likely going to experience the world as meaningless. And by contrast, if we espouse a belief that the world is meaningless, yet we love, we're likely to experience the world as meaningful, despite our ideological insistence that it's otherwise. And I think that's because in love, there is a kind of confidence that expresses itself as utter commitment. But the curious thing about this kind of confidence is that it's not directly connected with intellectual affirmation. This is a very important turn in this idea. Love expresses a kind of confidence that shows itself as utter commitment, but that commitment, that confidence, is not directly connected to intellectual affirmation. And in fact, in some ways, the confidence of love can be most visible when there's a lack of intellectual confidence. Now, before we all start to think that I'm making an argument that love is utter folly, which wouldn't be an original argument in any case, let me just unpack that a tiny little bit. One of the things that I get to do here a fair bit at the table, and at least over the last few years, is help folks that are in love and who've chosen the path of marriage as their expression of love and commitment to do some preparatory work for their marriage. And, when you ask my kids to pick a favorite, like, what was your favorite day on vacation? They're like, oh, don't make me do that. So I'm not going to say this is my favorite thing to do at the table, because that's impossible. But I love these conversations. Like, they are so much fun. And that's not because I think that marriage is some ideal or superior state of being. Having said that, I think it is unique and deeply worthy. But the reason those conversations are so much fun is because I get to spend time with people that are in love, which is, you know, kind of a blast. And we get to talk about all the sorts of things that go with that, and that's just so good. So, one of the things I've noticed about these conversations is that even if I wanted to, and I don't, but even if I wanted to, it would be mostly a waste of time for me to try to convince people in that setting that their relationship is statistically doomed. Well, okay, so statistically, the odds are 50-50. So maybe doom's a little strong. Stay with me, because the point that I want to make isn't actually that grim. Because, guess what? Even if I could convince those people that statistically the odds weren't especially good, the odds are excellent that they wouldn't care. They would be indifferent to my statistics, because loving someone entails, among other things, not balking at risk or uncertainty, but moving forward regardless. If I mentioned those kind of stats to a couple and their reaction to that information was like a full-on reconsideration of their relationship, I would probably start to wonder what the basis of the relationship was. And I would probably think that I would be better off trying to help them find a really good prenuptial agreement lawyer than, you know, talking about the things we usually talk about. The confidence that comes from love is not connected to the weighing of the evidence or to the endorsement of a system of belief. The confidence that comes from love is not connected to the weighing of the evidence or the endorsement of a system of belief. When I was in college, I had a friend who got me reading Blaise Pascal, the mid-17th century French mathematician, physicist, and theologian, busy brain. Pascal gave us lots to think about, but perhaps nothing easier to remember than his defining idea about love, which was that the heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. So this confidence that comes from love doesn't behave by the logic of reason. And that's not to say that it's irrational or divorced from reason. It's more like, to borrow a phrase from the philosopher Jacques Derrida, it's more like love produces a faith that is undeconstructible. My spell checker didn't know that word. It hasn't read Derrida. Faith, love produces a faith that is undeconstructible. I should probably mention that this idea is super exciting for me. And the reason I think I should mention that as a communicator is because when I get super excited about a nuanced idea, I talk slower and quieter because I'm thinking really hard. So if I just seem like I'm leaving the room, I'm just following the idea. I care about all of you. I'm trying to stay here. Despite the fact that I think there are really radical implications to this idea, if you roar past the nuances of it too fast, it can feel like just a great big so what. So I want to unpack undeconstructible a little bit. So remember, what we're trying to do here is to get a firmer grip on the kind of confidence that isn't affiliated with certainty, but that still moves us into action in the here and now. All right? So that's kind of what we're on about. First of all, something about the nature of the love that we're talking about. I've just illustrated part of this idea from the vantage point of romance, and I'm going to expand my illustration in that direction in a moment. This isn't an attempt to talk about God in romantic terms, something that isn't necessarily helpful, but it is an attempt to illustrate something about the nature of the relationship between what we might call love and what we might call confidence. And the most accessible picture, sort of the most recurring human experience I can think of to approach that is love. So I'll stay in that terrain for a little bit. When we fall in love, it's often impossible to actually define why or how that happened. And we might be able to tell the story of the circumstances, how the story unfolded. We met such and so, and then this happened, and then we had coffee, and then blah, blah, blah. We can kind of talk about how the events happened, but about that beautiful and often disconcerting feeling of love, it's not unusual to find ourselves feeling hard-pressed for words. I just leave it to the poets, who seem to do better. But here's a word that I like for love, both human love and divine love. The word is ethereal. Ethereal, maybe properly agreed upon as a definition. If you look it up, one of the definitions you'll find at the top of the list is that ethereal means extremely delicate and light, in a way that seems too perfect for this world. That's a fairly metaphysical sort of definition, isn't it? Extremely delicate and light in a way that seems too perfect for this world. When it comes to love, to that whatever it is that calls us into action on behalf of another person or of God, doesn't that sort of feel like a good word? Delicate and light in a way that seems too perfect for this world. Think about that as a way of trying to put words around what love feels like. Not unreal, but also not real the way that the floor and the walls and the ceiling are real. And faith can be like that. Faith can be a really hard to define thing that is still powerful enough to move us into action. Ethereal. Well, whatever language we might choose for it, it calls us into a loving and passionate commitment to another person, or in the case of faith, to the world. And in a response to a call like that, our inclination as humans tends to be that we want to make something. And so, with faith, what we tend toward is creating beliefs or systems of belief that are an attempt to embody our passionate commitment, to put that ethereal thing, that call, I use the word advisedly, that's why I chose ethereal to define it, into action. That's what we want to do. We're just, when that feeling is in us, we want to make something of it. And I know that I sometimes give systems of belief a bit of a rough ride. This feels like as good a context as any to add a little nuance to that. When we make systems of belief, we're making something with potential. At their best, systems of belief can be deeply transformative. Some of us in this room, personally, most of us in this room, by extension to someone else's story, probably know of a life that has been overhauled by encountering a system of belief, sometimes beautifully overhauled. I heard somebody talking about an immersive recovery program experience last week, and they said, I don't want to sound melodramatic, but this saved my life. So we know stories like that. Maybe we have lived a story like that. So far, so good. Here's the part that might seem like a tweak, but from my vantage point, at least, I would say it's more like a game changer. When it comes to religious systems of belief, no matter how transformative they may be, and they may be very transformative, they are not the same thing and never should take the place of faith. Systems of belief and faith are not synonyms. They're not the same thing. That's what we've been talking about this whole time. And if you feel like, depending on how you understand the tradition and the text, if you want to reference the Jesus story for this, just look up Jesus' commentary on the Sabbath, made for humanity, not humanity made for the Sabbath. What that means, among other things, is that faith demands both that we form views and opinions about how best to live in the world. That's what we do when we have that feeling, right? That's where we go. We start making things. So faith demands that we do that, that we form views and opinions about how best to live in the world, but that we do so in the conscious knowledge that those views need to be fluid and open and available to being revisited in the light of new circumstances and new situations. They are not faith. They're what we make because we have faith. Not the same thing. One of the obvious implications to this line of thinking to me is that we would, if we were conscious of that understanding, when we were making or living out systems of belief, one of the things that would step to the side would be hubris. This overweening sense that I am right and you are wrong, and that allows me to other you and judge you and dismiss you or treat you like you're just operating on a different level than I am. But if you make faith and systems of belief synonyms, if you take the strength of the feeling that produces a desire to make something, and you make them, you align them totally, that vulnerability is built right in to that. Back to human loves to help us imagine this maybe a little bit. I'm going to use lover, beloved language for this because I'm a cisgendered straight guy, and I would naturally default to him and her language, but I don't want this idea to get stuck in sort of the, you know, heteronormative part of our understanding. So, lover, beloved. If we want to imagine what undeconstructible faith looks like, it might help us to imagine a lover complimenting their beloved. Leah and I, most of you know who Leah is. If you don't, just watch for a person about this high with a ton of energy and these fabulous black little pigtails going on when the kids come back in. Leah always has something to share with me on any given morning. This morning, she shared with me what she has learned about the nature of compliments. Yes, her word, compliment. It's an awfully long word for a not very tall person, but she had it right. We had a lovely conversation about compliments. Leah regards me as her friend, which is one of the greatest gifts I can imagine. It's awesome. Now, if we are complimenting someone that we love, we might say that that person is beautiful, strong, wonderful, smart, thoughtful, gentle, funny, passionate. We'd come up with the list, right? We would talk about the things that we can use those sort of adjectives for. But there is no collection of adjectives that's actually going to encapsulate why we love that person. And as long as that love keeps growing, the lover is going to need to find new words for the beloved. The old ones are going to get replaced. And the new ones won't be any more permanent than the old ones were, because none of them are going to capture that love in any absolute way. Now, somebody else might see all those same qualities in the beloved and remain relatively indifferent to that person. It's not that the lover sees some properties that others can't, but that they view the beloved in ways that the others don't. The lover doesn't see more than any other person, but they hold what they see in a different way. For the lover, the beloved isn't reducible to their attributes. It's actually a really good litmus test for people talking about relationships. If they can reduce the person to their attributes, that's a clue. And that's because the lover experiences the beloved as irreducible to a collection of properties. And it's the love itself that makes the beloved be experienced as uncontainable and unnameable. That's the mystery part. The motivation to compliment is the result of the love that cannot be put into words. Remember, we're trying to understand undeconstructible in all of this. If you want to put it into that language, the undeconstructible part is what motivates the words, not the words themselves. The words are the symptom. The love is the disease. Right? It's that undeconstructible love that, in what we've been exploring this morning, is analogous to confident faith as opposed to certainty. And the compliments are analogous to the systems that we make. Does that make sense? Did that connect the dots? I'm hoping that it does. It's the undeconstructible nature of love that I wish to help us think about or try to imagine as analogous to confident faith. So faith that is not aligned with certainty, but that still produces utter commitment and action. And the compliments in that story about the lover and the beloved are analogous to the systems we make. Small wonder that we feel so attached to our systems of belief, given what provokes their making. But unless we consciously understand them to be separate things, we operate with the vulnerable misunderstanding that faith and systems of belief are the same thing. And they're not. If we have faith in a system of belief, we will find ourselves almost irrevocably drawn to the task of trying to make our belief system behave with certitude, as though there were no other possible understandings of whatever the mystery is around which we have made that system. But if we can hold those things loosely, fluidly, open to reconsideration, without believing that to reconsider them undoes the love that provokes us to make them, we find ourselves operating spiritually in a very different space, one with way, among other things, way, way more freedom to think for ourselves. Way more freedom to act in the world. Way more freedom to rejig a system of belief because it no longer applies, or the circumstances have changed, or new information has come into the equation. Like the beloved changes, and we have to find new adjectives. But the love that provokes the making of the adjectives is the undeconstructible part, is still firing right along. Does that make sense? I'm sure Mr. Derrida would have me for lunch philosophically, but that's where I'm going to leave it anyway. If you are inclined to read a biblical text that illustrates at length the distinction between the undeconstructible thing that we've been calling love and the systems that we're motivated to make in response, just take yourself straight to that famous wedding text, 1 Corinthians 13. Now, listen to the first couple of verses of this, in light of the idea of undeconstructible and the things we make. Because 1 Corinthians 13 lists some great things that we could make and says they're not the same thing as the undeconstructible part. Just listen to this. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, that'd be quite a thing to be able to do. But I do not have love. I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy, I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge. Remember, this is Paul, the same guy who was talking about wisdom and signs when we read some of his texts previously. If I have all those things, I can do all that. I have the gift of prophecy. I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge. I have a faith that can move mountains, but I do not have love. If I don't have the undeconstructible part, I'm nothing. If I possess, give all I possess to the poor, that's a good system. Give over my body to hardship that I may boast. In other words, I'm willing to suffer for my system of belief, but I don't have love. I gain nothing. He's not arguing that those things are bad things. They arise from the undeconstructible. They are not the undeconstructible. Not the same thing. Anyway, that's a long text, and it goes on in this vein for its entirety. I'm not going to read it all to us this morning, but if you want to pursue this further from the vantage point of sacred text, then just go take undeconstructible and systems of belief as not the same thing with you in your imagination and read through 1 Corinthians 13 and see what bubbles up. All right. Next week, an extended rant on why Advent matters in the 21st century. All right. Peace.